Morning, everybody. Thank you for coming today. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Bob Lamb. I'm a senior fellow in the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project. I want to let you know that we are recording this morning's session, just for your information. We have a sign-in sheet that we would love for you guys to fill out so we can know who you are. I would like to before introducing our speaker today, I'd like to just very briefly go around the room just to see, tell us your name and where you're from, and just so we can have a sense for who's here.
I'm
Donna Reed, ARD.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute.
Chuck Roth, there
Well, thank you very much. Melissa Payson's done some very interesting work in South Asia and some other regions. The bio is in front of you this morning, so I won't give a long introduction. We're going to listen to her speak for a bit, and then we'll have some good time for question and answer afterwards.
Great. I think I'll actually stand over there and see what we just So, as you said, I'm Melissa Payson. I'd like to, first of all, thank CSIS very much for this opportunity, which is an incredible honor, and particularly to Karen, for putting North Waziristan in the spotlight like this. The discussion today will be about a dialogue I had with North Waziristan leaders, tribal and religious leaders, about their perspectives on development. I'll go through as quickly as I can. Some of this many of you may know already. I'll just skim over the history and try to get right to their words, but give you a sense of the context, then talk about how the dialogue began and what they said, how we might manage the complexity and risk in that area, and also, most specifically, what action we can take. I am a practitioner. I'm not a policymaker. I've spent my career in the field, and so I always think about how can we make something happen, which is also typically American. The photos I've taken from various places, by the way, so none of these are from North Waziristan. And I have not been in North Waziristan either. So, as we all know, it's in a very interesting region, and in South Waziristan lately, I have a cold and I will try to keep going without losing my voice. In South Waziristan, there has been fighting lately, and it really is a critical region with India, Afghanistan. North Waziristan has been in the news quite a bit lately, including at the highest levels of the U.S. government. The system of governance is colonial. It is run by a political agent who is one person with almost absolute power on behalf of the federal government. There are reforms being discussed for the area, both in terms of the justice system and the political system. They are controversial. The tribal leaders are not necessarily all in favor of having the system change. But the area has now been opened to political parties, which is a major step. The government is weak. We all know that. That's why so much money is being focused on the area. And the tribal leadership is weakened as well, although in North Waziristan, the tribal leaders still do have a say, perhaps more so than in some of the other areas in Fatah. The border is an issue. Afghanistan does not recognize it. Obviously, there's a lot of movement back and forth in that area that is uncontrolled, both in terms of family, in terms of the insurgency. The Pakistan Taliban is obviously present in North Waziristan. The leadership there is not necessarily part of the TTP, which was run by Baitullah Masood, but they clearly have close relations. It is thought to be a sanctuary for Osama bin Laden. That's been stated pretty clearly by officials these past few days in the United States. It is the home of home base for the Haqqani network, which is Sirajuddin and Jalaluddin Haqqani. I'm sure everybody in this room is familiar with them. The home base is in host right across the border. And many other foreign groups. And I think what struck me particularly recently was David Headley, who has just been indicted for terrorist activities in Mumbai, wrote on a blog about how Miranshah, the capital, was just full of all different kinds of foreigners roving around on the streets, and he estimated about a third of the people he saw there were foreign. One of the most thorny issues about North Waziristan, even as I speak about development today, is that it is a training and a rest and relaxation area for many of the actors who are fueling the insurgency in Afghanistan. It is very undeveloped, like the rest of the tribal areas, and it has never had a lot of development like the rest of the tribal areas. I think you probably know, women's literacy is 3%, male literacy is, they say, 29%, 7,000 some odd beds, doctors per person. It's really been, the socioeconomic indicators are really poor. There is very little aid activity now in North Waziristan, and that has been true before, but now there actually is money that has been allocated, and that includes USAID funding, $750 million from a couple of years ago, with organizations that are working in southern Fatah to move that money into development programming on the ground. That has not happened in North Waziristan in particular. And it is sometimes referred to as not low-hanging fruit. So aid agencies are focusing on areas in the tribal areas that they think are easier, and they perceive North Waziristan as very difficult. Okay, I know that's really fast, and probably many of you can do a far better job on that. So let's talk about why am I here today. I first of all, have experience on both sides of the border. I worked in Afghanistan for 3 years covering Logar and Khost for the National Solidarity Program. And in that programming, I worked with a large number, hundreds of tribal leaders, religious scholars, ex-Taliban, and a whole variety of people that we integrated into the NSP programming. I received a phone call from a family from North Waziristan last year. And they said, well, we were talking to our relatives in Khost, and they said if we wanted to talk about development projects, we should call Melissa. So somehow they tracked me down. I confirmed that they were from the family that they said they were. That was very easy. It took about 10 minutes. And then I said, great, let's talk about development. I'm an independent consultant. I was not directly involved with any programming or money going on there, and I still am not. That led to an opportunity to sit down with tribal and religious leaders and talk to them, really start to open the discussion on what is it that they are interested in, what it is that they are concerned about, and what do they demand in terms of development. You can't work in a place like North Waziristan without actually having the agreement of the power holders there. So asking them what their perspective is obviously very important to begin to understand how you can work. This dialogue was focused on tribal leaders and religious scholars as power holders with the understanding, as I understood, the Taliban is there. I did not directly reach out to them, but I will speak in a little bit about how they were somewhat involved. Beyond looking at their interests, concerns, and demands specific to development, to really talk to them about foreign assistance. Was it possible? Was it not? If it's not possible, then I am a big believer. If they say no, I think it is no. You can't really go in there. There's not a way to sneak in there and hope nobody will know when you're bringing in foreign funding. They do know. And what they don't know, they will make up. Also, I wanted to catalyze the discussion with them on how can we go forward, to actually have them start to think about it. They don't necessarily, the leadership and the people don't necessarily understand how development works, how they can bring about improvements. They have something like a macro idea of, yeah, we want things to get better. So by talking with them quite specifically about, not about needs, but I talked about authority, decision-making, management, who has the power, who should have the power, who is involved, who should be involved, how are decisions made, how should they be made, who should be involved in that. By beginning to ask those questions, I was hoping to actually really spark some of their thinking. But, well, you know, we haven't really thought about that. How could it be? And finally, the research that I did was to provide some evidence for the aid community going forward, so that we're not just speculating or assuming, oh, they don't want it, oh, it's too difficult, oh, they'd reject it because it's foreign aid. Let's ask them and start there. So here's one of the interesting things. Who did I speak with? Who were the power holders? Well, the way it worked, after I was contacted by this family from North Waziristan, they spoke with tribal leaders from a variety of tribes. And within them, among themselves, they decided who would participate in these development discussions. And as you can see, the gray area were the representatives of the tribes I spoke with. I'm using the word tribe very loosely. Even the list of the tribes on the right, those are more like clans, and some have higher authority than others. But the major ones are the Dawar and the Wazir, with some of the major groupings being Torihel, which you can see on the bottom area, and Madahel, which is on the border with Afghanistan. The tribal leaders decided themselves who would come to speak with me. And as it turns out, as you can see from the gray area, it was a fairly significant coverage. These turned out to be influential leaders. Some of the top leaders, some of the most senior Maliks, tribal leaders in that area, participated, and including some of the cross-border tribes, such as Kabulkel, which goes into Paktika on the bottom left, you can see there. What was also interesting to me was who did not participate, which, as you know, an aid worker, you always have to pay attention. And I asked them about that. What about these other, other groups? Where are they? Why aren't they here? And the response from these other senior tribal leaders was, well, don't worry about them. They're not so important anyway. And I said, okay, fine. Obviously, I did not lose sight of them. But I think what comes out from this, one of the first important points about coalitions, is that they created this coalition themselves to decide who would speak with me and who would be willing to go forward with this some kind of development discussion, which potentially might lead to actual work on the ground. Now, how does the Taliban fit in with this? After I first spoke with the tribal leaders, they went back and some of them discussed with some lower-level Taliban leaders, Alim Khan and Sadiq Noor, those names came up, to say, look, there's this discussion going on, we want to take it further, we think it was very interesting. They discussed this among themselves, and apparently at first there was no real reaction. Then the tribal leaders came back, and as one religious scholar said to me later, they got a little bit upset, one tribal leader. And so finally it was taken seriously, and a delegation of religious scholars and tribal leaders, a subgroup of the group I spoke with, went to talk to Hafiz Gulbahadur, who is the top Taliban leader in North Waziristan, about continuing the discussions. This was in January, which was a very interesting time in that area anyway, when apparently the coalition was being discussed between three top Taliban leaders, including Hafiz Gulbahadur, and apparently with the participation of the Haqqani Network or with the Mullah Omar's insistence, it's not really clear. But at any rate, while those discussions were going on, apparently, this top Taliban leader in North Waziristan said, yeah, go ahead, talk to the American about, you know, that American girl about development. And so they did. Within the group of tribal leaders, clearly there were sympathies with Taliban. I mean, that's always true. You don't know who, you don't know how. There were also those who I'm very sure were not sympathetic at all. But it's the typical complex scenario that we have in Afghanistan, Pakistan, anybody knows who's worked there. And I think that was great. I was really happy to have anybody at the table to poke around and see what development was about. So we really looked at the power holders because they can influence public opinion. The tribal structure still works. They can take decisions. They can uphold decisions. This group that I spoke with, they have that influence and authority. And they also obviously shape the security and the operating environment if you're going to do aid in there. And they can potentially be spoilers, so you want them to know what you're doing. I will move through some of these quotes fairly quickly, but I think that they'll be available later, so you can read them more leisurely. the senior religious scholar said to me, "We trust you, that's why we're here." And that trust was obviously essential. Not only the relationship, the ability to get to me, having heard about me from host, but trust. And when I say me, I just really see that as a message to the aid community and others. How can we work there? Because all I did was my work. I mean, I'm sort of an example of how we can do this maybe a little bit better. They made two opening statements, the religious leaders who met separately and the tribal leaders. This is Malavi Gul Ramazan. You can't see his name there, but he is an influential tribal leader. "Peace at any cost, stop attacks," meaning drones, "and then peace will come." He emphasized that education is important, including religious education. And we had further discussion about that in suicide bombings later, and that people don't really understand Islam. "Collective thinking is important. If we all agree on an agenda, nothing is impossible, and all is based on trust. As we trust you, so you must trust us." And I emphasize this because that needs to be built into the programming that we would do later. Tribal leaders and religious scholars, everybody emphasized education. It was number one in everything they were talking about. You'll see a little bit later one quote, "Without education, there will always be fighting." Far and away, that was what they wanted. They said, "Build the schools and bring the teachers to Waziristan, send our children elsewhere in Pakistan, send them outside of Pakistan. Just do it. Please educate our people." So, summary findings out of these hours and hours and hours of discussions. There's much more. I've really tried to keep it simplified today, but they said aid is needed. The lack of aid is fueling suspicion. They're starting to think who's taken our aid, and it's sort of having the opposite impact of what we would want, where they think, "Oh, you're here helping us, that's great." They're now thinking, "Well, where the hell are you?" They looked for partners to address the needs, and they included local government, they included foreign assistance, NGOs. They excluded the army. Go into that in a little bit more detail later. The delivery methods were essential. They said, of course, you have to respect Islam and the indigenous culture, Pashtunwali. And they wanted to see more shared decision-making and management, so to balance out the power right now, which is quite lopsided with the government, what little power it has most of the power there to make decisions. And they also wanted to see local investment, not the money filtering through agency after agency, so by the time it got to the ground, there was very little. We know these things. I think most significant is that they said them, and this really resonates with a lot of what the aid community talks about. So briefly, they said that they need aid. As I said, this was not the point. We didn't talk about all their needs. But they made the point that they really do need aid. And then they started to talk about how they see they don't have aid. In particular, I think the bottom quote is important, where they really were reaching out and saying, "Well, why aren't you all helping us? Put the pressure on the government so that we can get something going here." And that actually has a sharp, I think, tail at the end of it, where that's going to start to turn into anger and frustration against the international community if they see it not helping. Who were they talking about for partners? Well, in North Waziristan, they are not against the government, and that's sometimes confusing for people, but the issue there, as I said, is that it's a cross-border support for the insurgency in Afghanistan. They do support the government, and what does that mean? Well, essentially, they said, the government has not done a thing for us. It's really terrible. It's horribly corrupt. But it has to be involved in development. And they mean the political agent. That's the PA. And that is their closest government authority. As one said, the quote on the bottom again, I met with the political agent to ask about this specific program that has $20 million for that area, but the money hasn't moved in 10 years. And the significant thing is that this religious scholar, Malavi Gul Ramazan, said, "I asked Gul Bahadur, the head of the Taliban in North Waziristan." He said, yeah, go talk to the government. I know there are many different thoughts about that and the Taliban controlling that area, but there was agreement that the government needs to be involved. Now, there's also an interesting discussion on why should the government be involved. They welcomed foreign assistance. They said it had to respect Islam and their traditions. Now, this is actually, I'll go into that in a little bit, but that's a very interesting opportunity there. Little bit of dissonance between the tribal leaders whom I met with first, and they said, well, if the Taliban knows that the money's from the U.S., they would never agree. And then the religious scholars came, and this was after they had talked to the Taliban leader at any rate, but then they said, yeah, it's no problem. And they had quite a few quotes saying, we want the U.S. to come, we want it to invest in our economy, we have lots of resources. even if the donors are in America, we will come. The U.S. should not be so difficult. It should not be so difficult for us to get visas, et cetera, et cetera. So that was a much stronger positive message in terms of the U.S., but in general they said, we know the money's coming from foreigners. Pakistan doesn't have it. NGOs, sensitive subject, they don't like them. As some said, you know, we don't know what it is, but we know it's bad. Another one said they're proselytizing, and we know that they come to do development. That's not what they really mean. Some said, well, all they do is meetings and talk, talk, talk. Others said, you know, they're fooling around with our women, and that's totally unacceptable. But it was the religious scholar, one of the religious scholars, who said a madrasa is an NGO. And I think that's really important. It's true. And we need to start thinking about perhaps a different view of civil society in the tribal areas as well as North Waziristan before we can actually deliver aid in there. They excluded the army. And they did it in a couple of ways. In the newspaper, there had been articles, prominent articles, saying that NGOs and the army were not welcome. I thought one of my favorite quotes is, you know, media is very weak in our area. We specifically mentioned army, not NGOs. I think that's great that he's even thinking about the media. But they felt there was a lot of corruption with the army, and then one of the religious scholars told me very clearly, he said, look, when we negotiated the original agreement, the Waziristan Peace Accord, so-called, it was in the agreement that the army wouldn't bring development, but political forces could. And I really didn't totally believe that. I thought he was just talking. And then I got a hold of the agreement and I looked, and it is in the agreement. It's not specifically, it says the army can be there, but it needs to be basically confined to its bases unless needed. But it says that the development can go forward. And I asked them, why did you put development in that accord? And he said, look, the people keep coming to us and saying, we need this, we need this, we need this. We had to because the people demanded it. Now, what will be interesting is to see with the recent agreement that I skimmed over with the army to use North Waziristan's territory to get to the battle in South Waziristan, because there was an accord that just allowed the Pakistan army to move across that territory. It will be interesting to see, did they put anything about development in it, or what did that really constitute? And I don't know. I hope they did. They were in a good position. So apt delivery methods. This is really key to design programming that can be a credible vehicle, both for leaders to get behind and for the people to be involved with. Because as they said, if it doesn't respect Islam and if it doesn't respect our culture, we'll reject it. And that's very true. But as I found in Host, the leaders there said the same thing, and you would say, okay, fine, we agree. Well, then what? What should we do so that we can show that we do respect that? They had very limited ability in Host to give an answer to that. So we said things like with NSP, well, what about if we set up some advisory boards that includes government and tribal representatives and religious communities and Kuchis, you know, the nomadic people, etc. And they said, that's good. That'll be a good idea. And we said, well, what about if we do special action committees for religious affairs to provide a mechanism for religious leaders and madrasas to be involved? They said, yeah, that's good too. But we really had to help them to understand what some of the options were because they couldn't even conceive of this. And then it worked really well. I think the same thing in North Waziristan. To go from just saying don't defame our religion and respect our culture to finding the way to operationalize that. Negotiation is a really big aspect of the life there, and it's something that needs to be built into programming as well. They also emphasized working with jirgas. And jirgas, as many of you know, it's a mechanism and a process of collective decision-making, essentially. And it's been going on for centuries. They saw that really as a way to both make things more transparent, to share the authority around a group, and to mitigate corruption. And they included themselves in that. Women and youth, just touch on this briefly, it always comes up. They just saw no need. I say, you know, women, why would you involve them? Youth, they're children, they have nothing to offer. This is really typical everywhere. It's not just North Waziristan, it's not just Fatah, it's not just Afghanistan. I've worked in Kosovo, I've worked in Bosnia, same. And that is part of the standard challenge for aid agencies. So we need to find ways to work around that. Longer programming can help. When you go in with an 18-month program, which is maybe 500 days, taking out weekends, holidays, whatever, you're talking hundreds of days to where you say we're going to empower your women, it's not going to cut the mustard, and I think that's fair enough. you can see many of the leaders actually are young. And when we say tribal elders, they are not elder necessarily. Some of them are quite young. But these were not the youths they were talking about. They think of youths as just community, you know, guys. Just to touch briefly on drones, I don't want to go too far into this, but it did come up again and again and again. I know it's a hot topic. They said very clear, you know, respect our traditions. Well, our tradition is that we provide shelter, and I would hope they would have the same strength of conviction for aid agencies. But they again emphasized negotiation, and if honored, we will do anything. Drones are a big problem. They were affecting their constituents' faith in them because the leaders weren't able to stop them. I think it's a very complicated subject. I don't think there was any love lost with Baitullah Masood. For all I know, they celebrated when he was killed. They don't like the Uzbeks. They might like it when they're killed. There's probably a whole number of tensions within North Waziristan. Local investment in return, just briefly to touch on contracting, which was essential for them, especially the tribal leaders. They really wanted to see that money coming locally. They didn't want to see it being taken away in corruption. But when I asked them, what do you mean, you know, they don't like competitive tendering, which is what we all do in the aid community. I said, well, how would you do it? And they made it very personal, but they did have criteria that they thought were important. And especially in terms of working in their areas, they rejected what they called foreign contractors, which were contractors from Peshawar. But they did have a method in their heads where they'd said this would be an acceptable contractor to work within our area and this would not be one. And that is one good mechanism to invest locally. Okay, so I know this is terribly quick, but how do you manage that complexity and risk? Obviously, this is at the center of so much discussion here in Washington. On the left is a picture after a drone has hit. I think that was North Waziristan. And on the right, obviously, the military campaign in South Waziristan. That is just the tip of the iceberg. This is truly, there are so many powerful actors roaming around in there right now, that it is a challenge to weave aid programming through that terrain. Couple of key issues to highlight. One is exclusion and inclusion. Who do you include? Who do you exclude? In the aid world, we always talk about participation. We always talk about inclusion. But often what we do is we then hire people who come, young urban males who come from the nearest city to have them work in a place like North Waziristan. It won't work. They were very clear that in North Waziristan, they wanted something that was more inclusive, even with the boundaries like women, youth, etc. They pointed out that in other areas there was more conflict. Who would be involved? You know, how would the Taliban be involved? Now that the Taliban has said, we think it's okay to go talk to that American and to invite foreign assistance, essentially, they said something like that. How do you decide who can participate, who cannot? And there's issues on both sides. When you include a lot of groups with all the fault lines that are in Pakistan and they're in the tribal areas, that means you have to manage that. In Afghanistan, where we had tribal leaders, religious scholars, and ex-Taliban, those were not necessarily friendly relations between those people, and it took a lot of effort within an aid agency and within the managed program management to keep people focused on the same things and moving forward. But it's a very rewarding approach if it can be done, and it actually then moves programming forward on the ground because you actually have representative staffing. Other issues to look at: misuse, corruption, big issue. Security, is it safe enough? And then finally, inaction as an issue and as a risk. Briefly, I said to them, what is misuse? They came up with some very good answers to that. Misuse is everything on paper, nothing on the ground. Misuse is shares, where everybody takes some amount out of it. Essentially, what they did here is they showed that they understood what that was, and they therefore set a standard that they themselves can be held to as well. Inaction. This came through a lot. These are people, there's multiple power struggles going on within North Waziristan, obviously, and within those power struggles, they are also caught. They are seen as not delivering. We may say, sometimes people say, tribal leaders, how can you work with them? They're corrupt, they're old, you know, let's get rid of them, let's get on to the new. They are not able to deliver to their people, they don't have the means to do that, and therefore they are losing credibility, which leaves that gap for others to fill. So what action do we take? The first thing would be to actually respond to their appeals. We now have North Waziristan, which is believed to be, you know, the heart of extremism, home of Osama bin Laden. And in the meantime, you have tribal and religious leaders waving their arms in the air saying, please come help us. And so far, you can say something like nothing has happened. There may be some small things, but nothing. So I think the first thing to do would be to actually respond to that. And then to create an enabling environment for collaborative action. It is early right now. I don't think anybody would say, let's move in wholesale and let's just take care of this problem. They themselves called for a test. They said, let's try this out. Let's see if it could work. The first step would be to improve understanding, then to build confidence and unity, not to divide people or tribes or groups, but to really look to create that cohesive center of gravity and then strengthen it. And then look towards local investment. So that would mean improving communication, take the same kind of dialogue and extend it to local government, which has indicated it's interested in discussions I've had, and also with the usual civil society we think about, prominent people, influentials, NGOs, there are a few small NGOs there, civil groups. Demystify aid. Let's bring it down to a level where it can actually work in North Waziristan. Let's not design sophisticated programs on paper that sound really good, but let's keep in mind the environment we're working in. They, to me, they've given the indication both with the coalition they formed to talk about development, which was significant, but also with their comments, their responses, that they see development as a way to move forward and they want to keep that window open. Most importantly, negotiate the terms of that agreement first. You can't move forward without having everybody understand what are the principles we agree with, what are the practices that are okay, who's going to do what and how, what happens if we violate it. This resonates beyond the aid community, but it's really important. And we did a solidarity agreement in Host and Logar that worked really well. Very, very simple, but everybody sat around and said, yes, this is okay, yes, that's okay. But give it an institutional framework. They didn't even know about the FATA Sustainable Development Plan, which is the core document for bringing development to the tribal areas. Use the Pakistan procurement regulations and also develop indicators that are relevant locally. And launch a demonstration project where you then test out this agreement. But that agreement, that negotiated agreement, which speaks very much to how the culture works, would be essential to moving forward. Recognize that there is existing capability. You don't need graduate degrees to mobilize the Pashtuns. They can do it very easily. So bring programming down to a level where you're actually speaking to their ability to motivate their constituents and to move forward. Equitable access. Be sure when you sit down, you don't just say, well, we have a new paradigm here. This happened with NSP quite a bit. And then you say, but you tribes, you know, tribes are old, we're not interested. Religious madrasas, no, too dangerous. It's just open it up a little bit because you bring learning, you bring salaries, and you bring resources. And if that's shared more equitably, which they spoke to quite a bit, then I think that you have a firmer foundation for moving forward. Hire locally. It's not rocket science. It is not. Hire locally. Take the extra heartbeat of time it will take so that when you look at your staff, it doesn't look like guys from Peshawar or Islamabad, but you have a whole group of people in their turbans with their blankets, exactly the type of group I spoke with, who are then pulled into the organization, can see what it looks like, can poke around and assure themselves that if there's nothing nefarious, no proselytizing, etc., but that also makes them responsible. And then contract locally. And think of the tribes as a way, you know, as nations, I know that's a stretch, but to really start to think of them as a body that you can begin investing in, and certainly madrasas, and we did that in Post. And finally, bring the local firms to a level where they can do competitive bidding and do it well. So that essentially was that very quick summary of what all those hours of discussions were. They acknowledge that they need help. We have said we want partnership in Pakistan. We have said North Waziristan is critical. There is an opening, and I would say that let's go for it. That's it.
Thank you very much. You'd mentioned that they were very interested in their children getting education. Were they referring to boys and girls, or only boys?
One of the religious scholars said there is only one girls' college, women's college in North Waziristan. And my understanding that they meant both for boys and girls, The Taliban had issued an edict earlier that talked about separate education for both, but it did not forbid girls' education in North Waziristan.
Okay. Oh, I think we have a visitor listening in via telephone. Maren, are you in? Are you online? I don't think so. I think we must have lost the connection. So I'd like to open it up to questions. And please turn on your microphone before asking the question. Just briefly identify yourself, if you will. Sir.
There's so much emphasis in the Afghan programs like this about agriculture. You didn't say anything about that particularly. Was that something that in that physical area possible, or something that should be, that they would want? I don't know. You might just describe a little bit. Is it just all mountains or what, valleys? How is it sort of set up?
Yeah, I think the geography is a combination. There's some fertile river valleys and there are mountains. And there is agriculture there, subsistence, I think, essentially. I've not been there. I was invited, and I do hope one day to go. But I think that when they spoke about agriculture the way they did when we talked about needs was more about water the need for channels for their crops, et cetera. But I think almost any development would be welcome, and particularly infrastructure. But agriculture would be relevant.
Raghuveer Goya, India Globe, and Asia Today. You said that they told you that they want peace at any cost. But did you ask them what they are going to do with the Taliban? Basically, most of those who are supported by Pakistan, and I don't think they want peace because many people are getting billions of U.S. dollars in the name of peace in the region.
No, and I will say I kept these discussions very closely on development in particular because it was an area they had already indicated that there was an opening on. And what did he mean, at peace at any cost? I don't know. My sense was they meant stop the drone attacks and let's negotiate. So I don't know where they would take that discussion, but I do believe that the discussion needs to begin somewhere. I can't answer that for them, but I would certainly hope there would be some discussion about that. But I also would say my experience in Afghanistan and Pakistan is that even within families, you have maybe one son is in the Taliban, one son, you know, hopefully goes into the government, and they sort of straddle the different interests as both as a protective measure and as a way to influence. But I couldn't answer that for them.
Could you step up to the microphone?
Thank you, Samira Daniels. I've always been interested in the development end, but I just wanted to know, a practical question, whether anybody had seen Osama bin Laden, because, you know, that is really the thing that is just like, you know, creating distortions in the policy, and I was wondering if you had heard anything about this.
Well, if I had heard anything, I think there would be a lot of people interested. No. I did refer to al-Qaeda when I talked about security. Actually, particularly, I talked to them about a Canadian woman who was kidnapped, and what about her? They say development is okay. How is that possible? And I didn't know David Rode was there at the time. We talked about the Haqqani network, and the simple answer was, well, you know, they were bombed. The family, women, and children are dead, so don't worry. It's not a problem. I think the al-Qaeda was not at the center of discussion, and it is not. It's like with women's involvement, I might not start the discussion there. But I think building that relationship is really essential, something more than what we have now.
What you were able to do was predicated on trust, and good community development comes from there. You had the advantage of multiple years on the ground and kind of an inside connection. Can you say something about what you would do to achieve what you've laid out there when you want to enter a location where you don't have that wealth of trust built up, but you know you need to in a relatively short amount of time to start a development process?
Yeah, I think short amount of time is really key. You know, I think we all recognize that in our heads, and we need to start recognizing that in programming. Everything I've talked about today is really common sense, so I'm not saying I've got, you know, any new solution here. But I think it's really important how we worked in LOGAR and HOST, where we actually started by talking to the leaders and formulating how to move forward together. And that resulted in really representative staffing, really shared resources across many interest groups, and the ability for those people to look around very carefully and to get to know me or, you know, whoever was on the team. And that is really important. So you need to know your environment, and you need to recognize that there are multiple interests and not necessarily swing in favor of one. But time is also important, because I was there in the region for 3 years there and 3 years in Pakistan. One thing that meant was that I was accessible, but even more, it meant that when the phone call came, I didn't say, oh, my God, you know, it's North Waziristan on the line. Ah! And some might do that. I just said, oh, great, you know, let's talk. Let's see what we can explore. And that, it doesn't come quickly, but... And I think getting experienced people on the ground is key.
Hi, excuse me, Bill Bird from the World Bank. I completely agree on the need for taking time. And if you go back to National Solidarity Program, there was a quick design work in 2002. And the first 3 years, there were lots of complaints about how slowly it was dispersing and all that. And then by year six or seven, it actually, you know, once it got into place and functioning, and it took 2 or 3 years. And I think there's just no alternative to that. And anybody on the political side who actually thinks things can be done with quick fixes is just extremely naive. Now, my question is, because since you obviously were working very intensely on the National Solidarity Program, what elements, and to me the key element is actually a fixed grant to a community, which the community then within certain parameters decides how to allocate rather than people coming in and imposing projects. Now the question I have is, which parts of NSP do you think would be possibly replicable, say in North Waziristan?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of talk about NSP lately, and it's come into its own, and I just would say it's one of the most powerful programs I've worked on, and I'm glad to see that there are going to be some changes going forward. But one of the, we always talk about empowerment. Well, let's talk about power. Money is power, and they recognize it, and I think that having the communities have their own grants, but actually working more with them, perhaps treating it like a public budget, and together learning how to manage a budget would be very useful. And that has aspects of NSP in it. And I think the collective decision making, but moving the money closer to the ground, which is what they asked for, is really important. But because of the really poor relationship between the government and the tribes and the communities, I think that having, what they said was, a trusted interlocutor is important. And they saw that role, many of them, as an international organization that would control the financial resources with their consultation.
Yeah. Melissa, can I follow up on that? And thank you very much. It was a really fascinating discussion. Because one of the components of the NSP has been to bring women in a certain percentage. I can't remember what it is, but could that work in the Fatah region if you just said from the beginning part of the design process is 25% or whatever it is? And the second thing is, have you seen any of the indications of the political parties now being able to, you know, move into the integration there at all? What do you know about that?
Yeah, I think for women in HOST and LOGAR, HOST, of course, is a conservative area, with the solidarity agreement that we did, women's involvement was clear in the beginning, and that's also why we brought on religious scholars to talk through with them how we can make it acceptable for women to work, which is a sort of a slippery slope, but we did it. I think that the Dawar tribe is a bit less conservative than the Wazir tribe. And the Dawars were more open to saying, okay, look, yeah, women can be involved. They can do it maybe at the health clinics or whatever, because they do use those clinics. And they're in the settled, it's more settled area along the river. And The waziris were pretty much the ones who said, well, you know, don't even talk about it. But I think that beginning there, it is possible, saying that it will happen, and let's talk about the terms and how it can happen, and also recognizing that in a matter of days, like even if you're talking a three-year program, that's 1,000 days, minus weekends, and minus Ramadan, and haying, and all of that, you know, you're down to hundreds of days, and we need to balance that and look towards a longer relationship, which is what we're talking about at policy levels. The second question about political parties. I would just say I just could see, I knew some behind the scenes that there was a little bit of political something like affiliation already. I think it's going to be a very ripe area for political parties, and presumably everybody's maneuvering like hell right now to line up their ducks and capture their groups. But I didn't really see anything specifically.
Thanks for that great presentation. Tom Sanderson from CSIS. How would you characterize the presence of Central Asians in this area, specifically foreign fighters, and their role increasing, decreasing?
Yeah. I can't speak specifically to that, but I can say that, you know, my sense from the discussions I had is there was no love lost. And they said, you know, at one point one of the religious scholars said, well, they indicated that Hafiz Gul Bahadur more or less, and they controlled the territory, the tribes. And I think that was a little bit overstated. I think they've lost control of some of that territory. But they indicated, you know, we didn't want Uzbeks, and now Uzbeks are gone. And they indicated that Muslims and non-Muslims needed to respect their ways. And there was a really great quote from one religious scholar who said, you know, the Punjabis, I've told them again and again they have to respect our culture, and they just still don't get it. And I think that what he meant was he was talking about the army, but, you know, it could also, it goes well, it speaks to foreigners on the territory. By the way, they even referred to Afghans very naturally as foreigners. And anybody, we know that. I mean, working in Kosovo with the so-called, you know, all the Albanians, you could really tell who was an Albanian from Albania, who was an Albanian from Kosovo. They absolutely knew. And they know who's from Afghanistan and who's from Pakistan. And they recognize that those are different. So, and I think those tensions need to be spoken to. I don't think we should deepen those, because in the long run, it will serve us better to build cohesion than to have people fighting each other.
Thank you for your presentation. Ziya Mahir from the Rendon Group. I think there is no doubt that NSP has been a success in Afghanistan, particularly in Khost and Logar, because, you know, you have the strong tribal structure in their limited, you know, tribes, Zazi, Zadran, and Mangal, and those are the major ones who can implement those decisions they agree upon. And also, UN has been involved, you know, there since the 90s, so they are, you know, sort of aware with the community, you know, councils and getting together on issues. Of course, they have the Jirga system for a long time. But, you know, when you know, you look at the eastern part in Afghanistan, and over there, you know, when they agree upon in these NSPs on small issues such as, you know, building a bridge or, you know, whatever, electricity dam or whatever, then they're running into local governance, you know, and corruption with the local, interacting with the local government, and that's where you have a lot of the, you know, the governance and corruption issues. So now looking into the Fatah areas, what do you think will happen there if, you know, if they start getting together on issues, and also you have the, you know, the frontier crimes regulation and the political agent system, you know, which has pretty much secluded the area. So there is more, I think, political party probably, you know, need to involve and reach out to those areas and give them political freedom. But also, you know, the recent troop surge on the border, what do you think will have, will be their impact on the, you know, confidence building?
Yeah. Well, I think you've covered a huge amount of territory there, and I just speak to a couple of things. One, I wanted to mention the tension with NGOs is really palpable, and people have known that in the tribal areas in Fatah, and that's partly why there's sort of been a pseudo covert approach to go in there with the aid community, because they thought, well, NGOs are hated. They spoke about the Jirga. And they said, you know, community councils, as I'm speaking to with NSP, they said, you can't give a name to these councils because that makes them NGOs. It's Jirga, and we need to leave it like that. The strong tribal structure, I believe, is still there in North Waziristan. I could see the relationship between the tribal leaders, the religious scholars, and to a degree, the Taliban. There is a relationship there, but it is, you know, it is... They are together and they're not together. You know, everybody's watching each other a bit, but they all know each other. And I think that we need to be careful that we work with that tribal structure. Everybody's saying that now. But recognize that it has strength, even while we're not preferencing any particular group. And that equity and that unity, is equity especially, is really important. You speak about the Mongol. I worked with the Mongol under NSP. It's been very interesting now to see the Mongol have sort of swung, and that area is not hospitable to NSP at the moment. In fact, I heard a story recently that the local head of the Taliban there is the son of a CDC chair, and so he knows how the system works, and so he's just now requiring everybody to give 10% from their CDs, their NSP budget. But there's also, this is a little off topic, but the Taliban have now come out with their rules and regulations, and they speak to when can you take those monies, those public monies, and you can't take it after it's been given to the people, but you can't, it's also for booty, like weapons. You know, you can take it before it's been dispersed, you can't take it after it's in somebody's hands. So there's a little bit to work with in there, both making people understand that this can't happen, putting integrity at the forefront of the programming to sort of fight against corruption. Tribal leaders themselves are pretty corrupt, and some of them recognize that. Government is corrupt. Taliban came out today and said that some of the Taliban factions, the Mujahideen, are corrupt and will be taken care of.
For donors who might want to work with tribal leaders but might not want to work with Taliban, is it practical to try to segregate aid that way?
That's a hard question because it's just, I mean, there are sympathies even in people who are not officially in the Taliban, but they might sympathize or they might be affected, as you said, you know, by the drones or by the pressure of people flowing in across the border, by the situation in Afghanistan, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it is very possible to lay out some of these requirements and to have them respected to a degree. But I think ultimately, frankly, it's all going to be about negotiation, and I think the negotiation in Afghanistan is going to affect the negotiation in Pakistan, and that we wouldn't necessarily want to say, we wouldn't want to draw any lines too firmly. Let's not make spoilers.
I think we have time for maybe two more questions, if we could.
You mentioned the Army, NGOs, and the U.S. is three less welcome groups, to say the least, in any of these equations, at least based on the comments. Is there any constructive role other than complete evacuation of the area for any of those units? And would any of them have an opportunity to work their way directly or indirectly into a Jirga or something else that would give them some degree of credibility in working with those development units?
Yes, is the simple answer. First of all, I'm American and I'm female, and they contacted me, they didn't hesitate. So, you know, being of U.S. is not a problem per se. They did say that the U.S. was welcome. Even the tribal leaders said that their hesitation was how openly to do it, and I think that was addressed later by the religious scholars and the Taliban effectively saying, it's okay with development. So I think that the U.S. could play a role there, but needs to build that relationship. NGOs need to really change the way they work. They need to actually look like they belong there. They need to be of and by the communities and recognize that it's a tribal society, etc. And I think the aid community struggles. It understands intellectually, but it has a really hard time changing its shape on the ground, and that needs to happen. The Army is critical. I think the Army right now has basically said to organizations, stay out. We've done the war. Now we're going to do the reconstruction. You're not necessarily welcome. That relationship will need to be built carefully as well, even if the Army's willing to discuss it. And I hope to probe that a bit further when I go back. But it will be interesting to find out what the recent agreement was with the Army, because the tribes agreed with the Army to let the Army go through the area to fight Baitullah Massoud's or Hakimullah Massoud's Taliban. So I see a lot of opportunity, frankly.
Thank you for the talk. You sort of mentioned that you hope that the the local cultural trait of sheltering people who ask for shelter might also apply to NGOs, as it's kind of applied to Al-Qaeda and other foreign fighter groups. I was wondering if you could speak a bit more about that and what might differentiate foreign fighters and peaceful, more peaceful NGOs in the minds of the local leadership and culture, and also discuss how that might apply to non-NGO foreign groups such as businesses, for-profit businesses that might function in the area. With that cultural trait, do you think it would apply, or how would it be different than it is for different types of groups?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a real question about how far that trait does, how much it exists. But, I mean, they clearly said they still hold to that. And I think it's common sense. The aid community always, you know, tries to engage locally because that's a way we provide security and we know we can get into an area. They said, for me, when the religious scholar, the senior religious scholar invited me to North Waziristan, and he said, well, we shall put three people in your home, and you can come and you can stay for a month. And that was their way of giving surety. That was a very traditional way to do it, so that, you know, essentially three will be hostage in Islamabad while I'm off in Miranshah. That would take some trust. But hey, why not? I think that they had actually hosted Canadian company, they told me, some months before I met with them, that was in there looking for at some mineral, I don't know what it was, and they said, yeah, they provided protection for them while they went in to assess it on the ground. I think it's very much relevant. And the thing is that you need to have that agreement, and not just with one leader, but, you know, again, that coalition. If they agree, that's a pretty powerful approach, and I think that they would. They said they would.
I want to thank everybody for coming out this morning. I'd also like to acknowledge the support for the post-conflict reconstruction project that that Carnegie Plowshares and the government of Norway has provided us over the years. And, of course, thank you very much, Melissa Payson. You've given us a lot to think about. Anybody who's interested, we're going to post this as audio on our website, as well as possibly some of the slides. And if you haven't given us your contact information, we'd love to stay in touch with you. Thank you very much, Melissa.
Great.